Part 3. 21st Century Arc. Chapter 22. April 4th, 2001. Buenos Aires, Argentina. Premier opera houses throughout the world are judged by singers and musicians for their acoustics, the quality of sound that carries from the stage to the box seats and then to the gallery far up in the stratosphere. To the opera lovers who buy the tickets, they are ranked and admired more for their elegance and flamboyance. Some are noted for their baroqueness, others for pompousness, a few for trappings and festoons. But none can hold a candle to the unmatched grandiloquence of the Teatro Colón on the Avenida Nueve de Julio in Buenos Aires. Construction began in 1890, and no expense was spared. Completed when Puccini reigned supreme in 1908, the Teatro Colón Opera House stands sidewalk to sidewalk on one entire block of the city. A spellbinding blend of French Art Deco, Italian Renaissance, and Greek Classic, its stage has felt the feet of Pavlova and Nijinsky. Toscanini conducted from its podium, and every major singer from Caruso to Callas has performed there. The horseshoe interior is decorated on a grand scale that boggles the eye. Incredibly intricate brass moldings on the upper railings, sweeping tiers with velveted chairs and gold-brocaded curtains, spanned by ceilings filled with masterworks of art. On dazzling opening nights, the society elite of Argentina sweep through the foyer with its Italian marble and beautiful stained-glass dome, up the magnificent stairways, through the glitter, to their luxuriously appointed seats. Every seat in the house was occupied 60 seconds before the overture to the opera The Coronation of Papia by Claudio Monteverdi, except for the preeminent box on the right side of the stage. That was still empty. Papia had been the Roman Emperor Nero's mistress during the glory of Rome. Yet the singers wore costumes from the 17th century, and to rub salt in the wounds, all the male parts were sung by women. To some opera lovers, it is a genuine masterpiece. To others, it is a 4-hour drone. A few seconds before the house lights dimmed, a party of one man and 4 women flowed unobtrusively into the remaining empty box and sat in the maroon velvet chairs. Unseen outside the curtains, 2 bodyguards stood alert and fashionably dressed in tuxedos. Every eye in the opera house, every pair of binoculars, every pair of opera glasses automatically turned and focused on the people entering the box. The women were dazzlingly beautiful, not simply pretty or exotic, but shimmering beauties in the classical sense. Their matching flaxen blonde hair was coiffed in long ringlets below their bare shoulders, with tightly woven braids running across a center part on top. They sat regally, delicate hands demurely laid on their laps, staring down at the orchestra pit through uniform blue-gray eyes that gleamed with the intensity of moonlight on a raven's wing. The facial features were enhanced with high cheekbones and a tanned complexion that might have come from skiing in the Andes or sunbathing on a yacht anchored off Bahia Blanca. Any one of them could have easily passed for 25, although they were all 35. It took no imagination to believe they were sisters. In fact, they were 4 of a brood of sextuplets. Enough of their body proportions could be discerned through their dresses to show that they were trim and fit from arduous exercise. Their long shimmering silk gowns with dyed fox trim were identical except for color. Sitting in a semicircle in the box, they radiated like yellow, blue, green, and red sapphires. They were bejeweled in a glittering display of comparable diamond chokers, earrings, and bracelets. Strikingly sensuous and sultry, they had an ethereal, untouchable goddess quality about them. It seemed unthinkable, but they were all married, and each had given birth to 5 children. The women were attending the opening night of the opera season as a family affair, graciously nodding and smiling to the man who sat in their midst. Ramrod Straight, the male centerpiece, possessed the same hair and eye color as his sisters. But there any further resemblance ended. He was as handsome as his sisters were stunning, but ruggedly so, with thin waist and hips accented by lumberjack shoulders and a weightlifter's arm and leg muscles. His face was square-cut, sporting a chin indented with a dimple-like cleft, an arrow-straight nose, and a head jungled with thick blonde hair through which women dreamed of running their fingers. He was tall. At 6 feet 6 inches, he towered over his 5-foot-10-inch sisters. When he turned and spoke to his siblings, he smiled, flashing brilliant white teeth framed by a friendly mouth that found it impossible to turn down in a grimace. The eyes, though, showed no warmth. They stared as if they belonged to a panther gazing over the grasslands in search of prey. Carl Wolf was a very wealthy and powerful man, the chief executive officer of a vast family-owned financial empire that stretched from China through India and across Europe over the Atlantic, and from Canada and the United States into Mexico and South America. He was stupendously rich. His personal wealth was estimated in the hundreds of billions of dollars. His vast conglomerate, engaged in a multitude of scientific and high-technology programs, was known throughout the business world as Destiny Enterprises Limited. Unlike his siblings, Carl was unmarried. Wolf and others of his family easily could have slipped into the new Argentine celebrity society. He was sophisticated, confident, and prosperous. And yet he and the other members of his family lived frugally, considering their vast fortune. But the Wolf family dynasty, consisting of incredibly over 200 members, was seldom seen at fashionable restaurants or high society functions. The Wolf women almost never made their presence known in the exclusive stores and boutiques around Buenos Aires. Except for Carl, who made a show of openness, the family remained low profile and reclusive, and was a great mystery to Argentinians. There were no friendships with outsiders. No one, not even celebrities and high government officials, had ever cracked the Wolf family shell. The men who married the women in the family seemed to have come from nowhere and had no history. Strangely, they all took up the family name. Everyone, from the newest born to the most recently wed, carried the name of Wolf, whether male or female. They were a fraternal elite. When Carl and his 4 sisters showed up on opening nights at the opera, it was a major gossip event. The overture ended and the curtains pulled open, and the audience reluctantly turned their attention from the stunning and resplendent brother and sisters sitting in the premiere box and gazed at the singers on the stage. Maria Wolf, the sister sitting immediately to Carl's left, leaned over and whispered, "Why must you subject us to this terrible ordeal?" Wolf turned to Maria and smiled. "Because, dear sister, if we didn't display the family on different occasions, the government and the public might begin to think of us as a gigantic conspiracy wrapped in an enigma. It's best to make an appearance occasionally to let them know we are not extraterrestrial aliens bent on secretly controlling the country." "We should have waited until Heidi returned from Antarctica." "I agree," whispered Gelly, the sister on Wolf's right. "She's the only one who would have enjoyed this awful bore." Wolf patted Gelly's hand. "I'll make it up to her when La Traviata opens next week." They ignored the stares of the audience, who were torn between observing the elusive Wolf family and the singing and acting on stage. The curtain for Act 3 had just risen, when one of the bodyguards entered from the rear hall and whispered in Wolfe's ear. He stiffened in his chair. The smile vanished, and his facial expression turned grave. He leaned over and spoke softly. "My dear sisters, an emergency has come up. I must go. You stay. I've reserved a private room at the Plaza Grill for a little after-show dinner. You go ahead, and I'll catch up later." All four women turned from the opera and looked at him with controlled trepidation.
"Can you tell us what it is?" asked Gelly.
"We'd like to know," said Maria.
"When I know, you'll know," he promised. "Now enjoy yourselves." Wolfe rose and left the box, accompanied by one of the bodyguards, while the other remained outside the box. He hurried out a side exit and slipped into a waiting limousine, a 1969 Mercedes-Benz 600, a car that after more than 40 years still retained its reputation as the world's most luxurious limousine. The traffic was heavy, but then it was never light in Argentina. The streets were busy from late evening through to the early morning hours. The driver steered the big Mercedes to the barrio of Recoleta, which was centered around the lush gardens of the Plaza Francia and the Plaza Intendente Alvear. It was considered Buenos Aires' answer to Michigan Avenue in Chicago and Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills, with its tree-lined boulevards featuring chic stores, exclusive hotels, and palatial residences. The car passed the renowned Recoleta Cemetery, with its narrow stone paths squeezed between more than 7,000 ornate and statued mausoleums, with bands of concrete angels watching over the inhabitants. Eva Perón rests in one belonging to the Duarte family. Foreign tourists are usually amazed that her epitaph on the gate to the crypt actually reads, "Don't cry for me, Argentina. I remain quite near you." The chauffeur turned through guarded gates, past a spectacular wrought iron fence, and up a circular drive, stopping at the portal of a huge 19th-century mansion with tall colonnades and ivy-covered walls that had been the German embassy prior to World War II. 4 years after the war, the German government had moved its diplomats to a fashionable enclave known as Palermo Chico. Since then, the mansion had served as the corporate headquarters of Destiny Enterprises Limited. Wolfe exited the car and entered the mansion. The interior was anything but sumptuous. The marble floors and columns, the richly paneled walls, and the tile-inlaid ceilings were a reminder of a fabulous past, but the furnishings were sparse, and any sign of elaborate decor was non-existent. There was a white marble staircase leading to the offices above, but Wolfe stepped into a small elevator concealed in one wall. The elevator rose silently and opened into a vast conference room, where 10 members of the Wolfe family, 4 women, 6 men, were waiting seated around a 30-foot-long teakwood conference table. They all stood and greeted Carl. The most astute and perceptive of his vast family, at only 38 he was accepted and respected as the family's chief advisor and director. "Forgive my tardiness, my brothers and sisters, but I came as soon as I received word of the tragedy." Then he walked over to a gray-haired man in his late 40s and embraced him. "Is it true, Father? The U-2015 is gone, and Heidi with it?" Max Wolfe nodded sadly. "It's true. Your sister, along with Kurt's son Eric and the entire crew, now lie on the bottom of the sea off Antarctica."
"Eric?" said Carl Wolfe.
"I wasn't told at the opera that he was dead, too. I did not know he was on board. Can you be certain of all this?"
"We've intercepted the National Underwater and Marine Agency's satellite transmissions to Washington," said a tall man seated across the table, who could have passed for Carl's twin. Bruno Wolfe's face was a mask of anger. "The transcriptions tell the story. While carrying out our plan to eliminate all witnesses to the Amini's artifacts,
Our U-boat was firing on the Numa research ship when a United States nuclear submarine arrived and launched a missile, destroying the submarine and everyone on board. There was no mention of survivors.
A terrible loss, Carl murmured solemnly. Two family members, and the venerable old U-2015.
Let us not forget that she transported our grandparents and the core of our empire from Germany after the war.
Not forgetting the valuable service she provided over the years, added Otto Wolf, one of eight of the family's physicians. She will be sorely missed.
The men and women at the table sat hushed. This was clearly a group who had never experienced failure. For 55 years, since its inception, Destiny Enterprises Limited had operated with success piled on success. Every project, every operation, was planned with detailed discipline. No contingency was overlooked. Problems were expected and dealt with. Negligence and incompetency simply did not exist. The Wolf family had reigned supreme until now. They found it nearly impossible to accept reverses beyond their control. Wolf settled into a chair at the head of the table.
What are our losses in family and hired personnel over the past 2 weeks?
Bruno Wolf, who was married to Carl's sister, Gelly, opened a file and examined a column of numbers.
7 agents in Colorado, 7 on St. Paul Island, including our cousin Fritz, who directed the operation from his helicopter, 47 crewmen of the U-2015, plus Heidi and Eric.
67 of our best people and 3 of our family in less than 10 days, spoke up Elsie Wolf, wife of Bruno. It doesn't seem possible.
Not when you consider the people responsible are a bunch of academic oceanographers who are little more than spineless jellyfish, Otto snarled angrily.
Carl rubbed his eyes wearily.
I might remind you, dear Otto, those spineless jellyfish killed 12 of our best agents, not including the 2 we were forced to eliminate to keep them from talking.
Marine scientists and engineers are not professional killers, said Elsie. Our agent working undercover at the National Underwater and Marine Agency in Washington sent me the personal files of the men who are responsible for our dead in Colorado and on St. Paul Island. They are not ordinary men. Their exploits within Numa read like an adventure novel series.
Elsie paused and passed several photographs around the table.
The first face you see belongs to Admiral James Sandecker, the chief director of Numa. Sandecker is very respected among the political power elite of the United States government. After an enviable war record in Vietnam, he was personally selected to instigate and run the agency. He carries great weight among members of the American Congress.
I met him once at an oceans science conference in Marseille, said Carl. He is not an adversary to underestimate.
The next photo is of Rudolf Gunn, the deputy director of Numa.
An insignificant-looking little fellow, observed Felix Wolf, the corporate attorney for the family.
He certainly doesn't look like he has the strength to be a killer.
He doesn't have to know how to kill with his hands, said Elsie. As near as we can tell, he was the genius behind the loss of our search group on St. Paul Island. A graduate of the United States Naval Academy, he went on to a brilliant career in the Navy before joining Numa and becoming Admiral Sandecker's right-hand man.
Bruno held up a third photo.
Now, this one looks like he could tear coins from your stomach and give you change.
Albert Giordino, Numa's Assistant Special Projects Director, explained Elsie. A graduate of America's Air Force Academy. He served in Vietnam with distinction. Bruno is right. Giordino is known as a very tough customer. His record at Numa is remarkable. The file on projects he has directed to successful conclusions is quite thick. He has been known to kill, and from what little information we have been able to gather, it was he, along with Gunn, who is responsible for the annihilation of our St. Paul search team.
"And the final photo?" Otto prompted Elsie gently.
"His name is Dirk Pitt, considered a legend among oceanographic circles. The special projects director for NUMA, he is known as somewhat of a Renaissance man. Unmarried, he collects classic cars. Also a graduate of the Air Force Academy, with several decorations from Vietnam for heroism. His achievements make for heavy reading. It was he who frustrated our plans in Colorado. He was also present in the Antarctic during the sinking of the U-2015 by the American nuclear submarine."
"A great pity," said Otto in quiet anger. He looked from one face to the next around the table. "A mistake to have used her instead of a modern surface ship."
"A misguided attempt on all our parts," said Carl, "to confuse our enemies." Bruno pounded the desk with his fist.
"We must exact vengeance from these men. They must die."
"You ordered an assassination attempt on Pitt without the approval of the rest of us," said Carl sharply.
"An attempt that failed, I might add. We cannot afford the luxury of vengeance. We have a schedule to maintain, and I do not want our attentions misdirected to petty revenge."
"I see nothing petty about it," argued Bruno. "These four men are directly accountable for the deaths of our brothers and sister. They cannot go unpunished."
Carl looked at Bruno icily.
"Did it ever occur to you, dear brother, that when the new Destiny project reaches its climax, they will all die violent deaths?"
"Carl is right," said Elsie. "We cannot afford distractions from our true purpose, regardless of how tragic they are to the family."
"The matter is settled," stated Carl firmly. "We concentrate on the work at hand and accept our grief as part of the cost."
"Now that the chambers in Colorado and St. Paul Island have been discovered by outsiders," said Otto, "I see little to be gained by continuing to expend time, money, and more lives in concealing the existence of our ancient ancestors."
"I agree," said Bruno.
"With the inscriptions now in the hands of American government officials, we should stand in the shadows while they decipher the message and announce the Amini's warning of disaster through the international news media, thereby saving us the effort."
Carl stared at the surface of the table, his expression pensive.
"Our gravest concern is having the story come out too soon before the new Destiny project is launched and the disinformation leads to our doorstep."
"Then we must muddy the waters before scientific investigators penetrate our ruse."
"Thanks to those meddling rogues from the National Underwater and Marine Agency, the world will be on to us in 2 weeks."
Bruno gazed across the table at Carl.
"Is there any chance, brother, that our people at Valhalla can move up the timetable?"
"If I explain the urgency and make them aware of the dangers arising around us, yes, I believe I can inspire them to move up the launch date to 10 days from now."
10 days, Krista repeated heatedly. "Only 10 days before the old world is destroyed and the Fourth Empire rises from the ashes."
Carl nodded solemnly. "If all goes according to the carefully laid plans of our family since 1945, we will completely alter mankind for the next 10,000 years."